From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We have beauty, brains, and maybe some buyer's remorse on today's show. The Bronner Brothers International Beauty Show is back in Atlanta, and one of the event's featured guests is our guest today. Plus, meet a researcher who's found an easier, more affordable way to detect cancer. And while we're on the topic of affordability, can you afford to keep up with your rent payments in Metro Atlanta these days?
Pearl, I'm gonna pay you. I'm working three jobs right now, working nights. I'm driving a cab. I'm inside with my buddy right now, just going over my resume. You need to relax.
That's all this hour. First, though, we had a conversation about the controversy over Beyoncé's new song, Formation, yesterday. And we brought together four panelists to talk about why the reaction has been so varied and so strong. Freelance journalist Kate Forstall was one of our guests.
I think what a lot of people want to do is assume that Black people are completely comfortable in their presence, that everything is fine. And when someone with the power that Beyoncé has says everything is not fine, that turns a light back on us. And we have to ask ourselves why.
So here are your first thoughts.
My name is Regina McDuffie. I'm calling from Lodzella, Georgia. To put it in perspective for me, I'm a left-handed person in a right-handed world. Right-handedness is prevalent and people take it for granted. I encounter things every day that are difficult or cumbersome or, you know, have to be adjusted. And basically, I recognize those things because I'm left-handed. Same thing, we're Black in a white world. And there are things that we encounter every day that are uncomfortable, that are difficult, but white people don't even see it because the world revolves around them. We have to put the country in an uncomfortable position and hash this out. Otherwise, it's never going to be resolved.
We always love hearing what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Cobb County is changing. Plans to restructure suburban communities there have raised some questions about how low-cost housing should be managed. The latest neighborhood up for debate is Magnolia Crossing. That's an apartment complex that was put on the chopping block recently in order to build some high-end commercial properties. And that decision has displaced a few dozen residents. Nathaniel Smith is the founder and CEO of the Partnership for Southern Equity, and he's monitored suburban renewal efforts like this pretty closely. Hi, Nathaniel.
Good morning.
I wonder, one of the articles on this said, in Cobb County, the poor are being bulldozed. That comes from a creative loafing. Is that a headline grabber, or is there actually some truth to that?
Well, I think what we're seeing, you know, I think Cobb County is indicative of what is happening in all suburban areas right now in Metro Atlanta, where you see the changing demographics, both racially and economically, occurring in places that were not necessarily created or built to sustain that growth, a growth of a different population. Early on, the developments of those communities catered more around suburban living, a suburban lifestyle. And now we're seeing a migration of a population that requires more amenities, whether it be transportation access, transit access, or infrastructure around walkability or access to other services. And those communities aren't necessarily equipped and built to be prepared for the changing demographic shifts and migration shifts that are happening. And so what you're seeing is a clash, so to speak, between suburban values and a suburban perspective on growth and revitalization and the 21st century and what we're seeing in terms of the various changes that are happening, not only in urban areas, but suburban areas as well.
Let me try and play the role of somebody who's maybe a Cobb County commissioner and say, look, you know, we have a responsibility to our residents. We try to bring in economic activity. This is an effort to make Cobb County, you know, better for everybody, create jobs. And, you know, when you make an omelet, sometimes you're going to break eggs. But, you know, unfortunately, some people have to move, but they'll just need to find another place to move. What's the sort of equity answer, equitable answer to that?
Yes. So what I would say is that the equity answer is to not necessarily look at change from the perspective of doing for others in order to ensure that you're doing right by them, but to really frame the work around the interdependent nature of our communities and of our region.
But what does that look like in a on the ground in a pragmatic sense?
Right. So in a pragmatic sense, it's being more proactive as opposed to being reactionary, utilizing policies like, for example, an inclusionary zoning ordinance, which requires a certain percentage of housing units to be allocated towards affordability. Because one of the things that we don't want to see is a shell game, right? We don't want to see a concentration of poverty, for example, in the urban areas. And because of certain pressures and certain zoning, we see new concentrations of poverty occurring in suburban areas. And so we have to be more proactive in terms of utilizing policies that will encourage various choices of housing options in suburban areas that will allow people to live in those particular communities from the high chair to the rocking chair. And what we're seeing now is an abundance of homogeneous communities, right, where you have pockets of multifamily housing, pockets of residential housing, pockets of senior housing. And so what we have to do is do a lot more around developing mixed income environments. That is the way of the future. And by looking at communities, whether it be suburban or urban, as interdependent jurisdictions where what happens to the least of us affects what happens to the rest of us, I think we using that lens gives us an opportunity to develop a policy that is not only right, but also resilient, not only resilient, but also can play a role in revitalizing communities that are on the chopping blocks for disinvestment.
How important is the moment we're in right now? And I ask that because we've seen a lot of reports showing that rents in Metro Atlanta are rising at a pretty quick rate. Apartment vacancy is at its lowest point since 2001. The average rent for a two-bedroom place in Atlanta is now about $1,000 a month, which is considerably higher than it has mm-hmm. been. So are we at a moment right now where we could actually stave off some future problems?
Yes. I mean, I believe it. But I do believe, and I really appreciate you lifting this up. I think we are at a critical moment in the history of our region and in the history of our suburban areas. I think it now more than ever, we have to begin to think more around the intersectionality of various issues, whether it be around housing, whether it be around transportation accessibility, whether it be around access to services, because there won't be a magic bullet that will assist us in moving us out of the various challenges. So you see now where we have a region where over 90% of our job centers are north of I-20, no affordable housing, no pure access to transit or serious accessibility issues. And as a region, we cannot continue to grow in an unbalanced fashion. We can't have job centers predominantly on the northern side and only one job center, which is our airport on the southern part of our region. And so we have to begin to think in a more balanced fashion around growth. And if we don't, what we're going to see is a lack of opportunity for the majority of the citizens of our region.
We only have about a minute left, but to what extent is there a payoff for a politician? I mean, if they're trying to bring in more affluent members of their community, that means better taxes for the county or for the city, and that means they can do more. Mm-hmm. So what's their motivation for accommodating lower income people? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say the watchword is resiliency. The more diverse a community is, so you may have an opportunity if you have an affluent population to get a large amount of taxes on the front end. But will that community be resilient in the long run? Families can only have but so many children to go to a public school. As they get older, that diversity within their community will ensure that there's a level of fiscal sustainability in those communities. If you just have one, whether it be economic or whether it be sociological folks in a particular community, then there, it leaves little room for that community to remain resilient once that community goes through its financial growth cycle. And so I would say that, you know, whether it be diversity in terms of housing choices, whether it be economically, It ensures that communities remain more attractive and more resilient, and that mix creates a more diversity around financial and fiscal support for that local jurisdiction by creating diverse opportunities for people to live in those communities. And to be completely honest, we need more diversity in right. order to assist on the job side as well.
Nathaniel Smith, founder and CEO of the Partnership for Southern Equity. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's move from the suburbs to the city with some thoughts on how the working class affords to live in Atlanta. Post Properties Incorporated has plans to develop a 438-unit apartment complex and has pledged to reserve 10% of those apartments as, quote, workforce housing. Those units will be rented at a significantly lower monthly cost. And Atlanta City Councilman Andre Dickens says it's a step in the right direction.
If you choose to call Atlanta home, then you deserve access to great schools, safe neighborhoods, good transportation options, and housing options. Real meaningful options for our diverse workforce are critical to our success as a global city. Housing is really about people. Implementing a comprehensive housing strategy is one of the most important steps in improving the quality of life for everyone. The statistical evidence is clear, and the need is significant. In 2012, 40% of renters and 53% of homeowners were cost-burdened, meaning they spent more than 30% of their income on housing. Atlanta's comprehensive housing strategy released last year was a step in the right direction. Key strategies included reducing the number of Atlanta residents who are cost-burdened. Next, creating a broad mix of housing choices throughout Atlanta for a diverse workforce. And finally, reducing the number of vacant, blighted homes by 20% by 2020. From 2012 to 2014, 95% of rental units built in Atlanta were luxury units. These luxury units are out of the price range for much of our workforce. Furthermore, areas of Atlanta with the most jobs have the least affordable housing. This is why I am advocating for a citywide mandatory inclusionary housing policy that requires new residential developments to dedicate a percentage of units for our workforce. We want our teachers, firefighters, police, nurses, and office admins to have the choice to live in the communities they serve. Additionally, much of the city's current affordable housing stock is located in areas seeking amenities, including grocery stores, high-performing schools, transit, and job centers. Inclusionary housing could encourage investment in all neighborhoods. Disinvested areas that desire development begin to look more appealing to both residents and developers, providing the balanced growth that makes our city even greater. Once the next round of neighborhoods get hot, we will already have this policy in place that will keep at least a portion of each development for our workforce. History shows that affordable communities today may not be affordable tomorrow unless action like this is taken.
Atlanta City Councilman Andre Dickens. His full commentary on affordable rent in Atlanta is featured in Atlanta Magazine. There's a link to it at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. This is On Second Thought. Hospitals may soon stock breathalyzers as standard equipment, but not because they want to know how much alcohol you've drunk. A scientist at the Georgia Tech Research Institute has found a new way to possibly catch lung and breast cancers in their early stages using a special type of breathalyzer. Charlene Bayer is principal research scientist emeritus from Georgia Tech. Hi there.
Hi.
So first of all, when I say breathalyzer, are we really talking about the thing most of us see, like on when you watch Cops or something, that you put in your mouth and breathe into it?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to detect. For some things, yes, it will be something like that, where it's a sensor that will detect the breath. But for diseases like cancer, we don't want to do it that way. We've been told by the medical community that they don't want that. They don't want you to sit at your kitchen table and say, I have cancer. They want to know. So it's being designed right now for cancer as a laboratory test that can then, the doctor can look at the data and the results, and he can come back to you and say, yes, you have cancer. Here's our plan of attack.
But it's still something, if you go to the hospital to get tested, you're still basically just breathing into a tube.
Correct.
What is the machine looking for? Are there actual cells that are coming out of my breath that are cancerous?
No, we're actually looking at what are volatile organic compounds. These are compounds that vaporize easily into the air. And when your body does its metabolic processes that are going on, it releases different kinds of compounds. Some of those are very volatile, and those are released into the blood. And how the blood gets rid of those is by bringing them out through your lungs. And so that's what we detect.
So does that mean that it's easier to detect lung cancer this way?
It should be, yes. We have done lung cancer, and we're 75% accurate in our small pilot studies. We've also done breast cancer, and we're 95% accurate with breast cancer.
Holy cow.
And we can differentiate between the two cancers at 88% accuracy.
That's really amazing. I mean, especially in terms of the research we have now that shows mammograms are really not good at detecting cancer at all. When you talk about detecting with, 98% accuracy of breast?
95% of breast.
95%. How early are we talking?
We don't know yet because our studies are too small. Our study mixed the population from stage 1 through stage 4. And so we don't have the statistical basis at the moment to say this is a stage where we can detect. This is all research that still has to be done.
How do you test that? In other words, do you just take a group of people where the tester has no idea which person has cancer and which doesn't and gives them all the test?
Long term. I mean, our original studies, the studies we've done so far, we have known who has what. And that's allowed us to, we have a control group and we have a cancer group. And this is prior to treatment. You're almost a ghoul. They find out they have cancer, and we say, hi, will you participate in our test? And most people are more than ready. I mean, it's not quite that bad, but almost.
Scientists often have to, do unsavory things in the interest of science, right?
Correct.
So how exactly does the breathalyzer work? You say that it's detecting volatile compounds, but how can it be that accurate? Are there certain things that are showing up in the breath that are only present when one has a specific kind of cancer?
Well, actually, we may have identified one specific biomarker at this point in time for breast cancer. We're trying to confirm that right now, but that isn't really how we're doing it. It's a pattern recognition. We're collecting as many as 350 to 400 compounds. A portion of them are very important. They are the pattern signature. And some are more concentrated, some are less concentrated as the cancer proceeds. But they do seem to be specific to certain cancers.
And when you say that something is 95% accurate, that means if you test 100 people, 5 of them will get a false detection of cancer, or 5 of them you won't detect it and they do have cancer? What is that 5%?
That's correct. It's probably a false positive or false negative that would happen. But we're not pushing this as a pure diagnostic. And there's no cancer that's done with a single modality test. The most valuable thing for this is to make it a screening technology. You go in for your
physical,
the doctor tests you. It comes back and says, I think there might be a problem. Then we tell you to go and do the mammogram, do the ultrasound, go through the process. It's just right now it adds a step in front that is totally non-invasive that can be done as often as necessary because there's no radiation or anything like that. And so we can just keep doing it, and we can find out that way. Build, and the other advantage is over time, the doctor's able to build a database on you.
I'm assuming that it's much cheaper than what our standard tests are. Is that an accurate assumption?
Our estimate once we finish commercializing it is that probably about $100 a test.
Which is really cheap.
Right.
Especially if you actually look at what your insurance company is paying for a mammogram.
Correct.
How long is the road before we actually get to where I might go into my doctor's office and have them give me a breathalyzer for cancer?
It'd be a while. I mean, I'm not sure how many years. I mean, there's some things that we can do, such as we can detect hydration status, and we're hoping to commercialize that within a couple of years. But for cancer, it's going to be a while. You have to get FDA approval. You have to get the medical community to accept it and be comfortable with it.
And each doctor has to buy their own instrument?
Well, no, actually the way we're doing this, and that's another reason not to go to a full sensor system, is we have a very inexpensive device, just a, basically a Teflon bulb with what's called a rapid passive sampler inside. And that means it's a device that collects the air quickly, so they breathe through it, and then that's sent back to a laboratory, you know, my laboratory or clinical laboratory, and you
just
do the analysis of it.
Just a disposable little.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty useful.
Right, and that's one way we've brought the cost down versus a doctor having to buy something that's expensive that he might have to learn how to make. A patient, you know, some of the sensor things that are held in the hand, if a patient drops it, it's broken.
So remind me how important it is to catch cancer at an early stage. Does it depend on, depending on which kind of cancer we're talking about, whether it be lung or breast, is it not a matter of life and death if you catch it early?
Yes, it can be, especially with lung cancer, it can be.
So when you continue with testing and discover that this may actually allow you to detect cancer at a very early stage, that could be pretty revolutionary.
Correct.
Where are you in terms of your testing? What's your next battery of tests that you need to do?
Well, we actually right now are working on Parkinson's, early detections of Parkinson's. Through the breath. We are funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation with Emory University Neurodegenerative Center. Dr. Malu Tanzi is my partner in this. And we're seeing we can detect the presence of a unique signature for Parkinson's. And then we'll back up and see how early we can detect the presence of Parkinson's.
Charlene Bayer is Principal Research Scientist Emeritus at the Georgia Tech Research Institute. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
The who's who of the beauty industry will congregate in Atlanta this weekend for the annual Bronner Brothers International Beauty Show. We sent our producers to the show the last time it came to Atlanta in the summer of 2015, and they saw it all, from hair and makeup vendors to cosmetic demonstrations to a hair weaving competition.
Are you ready, competitors? I want to hear you. You may start now.
Producer Sean Powers met people from all over the country there, and he asked some of them why they got into the beauty business.
My name is Troy Adams, and I'm based in Connecticut. I work for the Hair Club for Men and Women. I do non-surgical hair replacement. I originally set out to be a child psychologist, but I always had a fascination with hair. It's constantly changing daily, so, you know, I'm all about that, you know, learning anything new and innovative, you know, just to make my craft better.
My name is Chaka Pryor. I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I'm an esthetician / makeup artist. As a child, I always liked makeup. I did a lot of coloring to curb my anger. The color pencils and markers helped me develop into an awesome makeup artist.
My name is Rocky Candola. I'm from Pascagoula, Mississippi. I sell natural human Indian hair. Indian hair is the most sought after hair in the world for the density, for the color, for the thickness from top to bottom. 7 months ago, I went to India on a vacation, met my wife, and started a company. Kind of just like a dream from 2 or 3 years ago that I never thought would happen, and it did.
My name is El Moniz. I'm from Jackson, Mississippi. I am a hairstylist. I wanted to be a lawyer, so I knew that I would need money to be a lawyer. So I said, okay, I can do hair. I'm going to do that first. But law school never happened. I fell in love with hair. And I love when women turn around and, you know, they see their hair for the first time. It gives them a whole new outlook.
Miko Branch has been answering this question about how she got into the hair business for a long time. She and her sister Titi took the industry by storm after they started a multi-million-dollar company called Miss Jessie's. Miko continues to represent the hair care product line, most recently this weekend at the Bronner Brothers show. I caught up with her after last summer's show in Atlanta. Now, you actually have a book out, which you say is both a kind of a memoir and a business guide and sort of explaining how you guys got into business. And I wonder, it doesn't seem like you necessarily separate the business from your personal life.
Oh, absolutely not. Our business is our personal life. It represents everything that we've been through, all of our experiences. We built our business based on our personal life lessons, our personal influences, like our dad, like our grandmother, like even my son. My son highly influenced me to get into the curly, kinky, and wavy hair market just by me giving him a bath, and I could no longer maintain my straight hair because he splashed around, and that made me embrace my curly hair.
When you started out, as a kid, you were doing your own hair. People loved it and said, could you do that to my hair, right?
Yeah, Celeste. You know, my mom and dad, they were in school, they were working. So my mom really never had the time for girl time. I was very much a girly girl, and I experimented with my own hair. I was really good at it. So everyone pretty much got their first, you know, hairstyle by me on the block. So I'm always loved it and so glad to be able to do it as an adult.
Now, you guys are part of what's known as the natural hair movement, which has actually been around for a little while. But for people who don't know what that is, can you kind of explain what this means to be part of a natural hair movement?
Well, you know, the movement is so much larger than hair. It's a lifestyle. It's people really trying to embrace everything that was God-given. When Miss Jessie's came around in the early 2000s, there was a very small group of women, and it was an older group of women who were frustrated with their hair. They'd been tired of relaxers, been tired of some of their edges being gone after pulling their hair tight after maybe weaves. And they really just wanted another option, something that was easy. And they just did a lot of research, started a conversation, and then it just became part of a lifestyle.
It's part of an identity, though, wouldn't you say? It's part of being able to say, I don't need to conform to certain beauty standards, and I'm going to let my hair do what it was intended to do from birth?
I would definitely say so. You have to understand women, particularly women of color, for so many years have been really, subscribing to an ideal that was so far away from what they had naturally. So to be able to embrace what they had God-given was really, it was a wonderful discovery. And many more women have gone back natural.
I mean, full disclosure, I use one of your hair care products. The Multicultural Curls is pretty much the only thing that keeps my hair from freaking out on a daily basis. Yeah. But I've always wondered, you know, I have to go to the African American section of whatever store I'm in, be it Target or wherever it is, mm-hmm. to get those products. Why don't major hair care lines have products that work on a person of color's hair? You know what I mean? I mean, why isn't this more embraced into your general hair care lines?
Yeah, I'm not really sure I can speak for them. I can tell you that as more women are embracing their curls, kinks, and waves, you have larger companies like Procter & Gamble focusing on this customer who wants solutions for her hair. Prior to Miss Jessie's, I'm not too sure why they didn't focus, because so many women have naturally curly hair. Once we started our product, Curly Pudding was our first product out, was so effective, and it was such a solution for women who wanted to embrace it. And as they started talking about it, it gained popularity. So now we have larger companies who are changing their focus.
Now, you're now running the company after the loss, very tragic loss, of your sister, who was both your partner and it seems like companion for most of your life.
Yeah.
What's that like now?
The loss of my sister, it's a tremendous loss, was such a devastating thing that happened to myself and my family. Titi Branch, was such an amazing woman, so innovative, so smart, so creative, so giving, so beautiful. Her contribution on this earth was so much bigger than a hair product. She really helped and assist people in trying to find their better self, and she started off with hair. For me, Celeste, I live to celebrate Titi. Her legacy is just so important. It's so much bigger than Miss Jessie's. So I can't do anything but be excited to spread the good word about Titi and continue on in all of her hard work that she put into this company on this planet, too.
Okay, so we have about a minute left, but I wondered if you'd speak to some of those voices you heard, people who are hoping to see the same kind of success that you've seen. What kind of advice would you give them?
I would tell anyone who is interested in starting a business, you know, have no fear. Do your research. Find out everything you need to know. But at the end of the day, get into it. Get started. The worst thing that could happen is you might fail, you might stumble, but it's wisdom for the next go around, and keep on trying till you get it right.
That is Miko Branch, the co-founder of Miss Jessie's hair care product line. She's also the co-author of the book Miss Jessie's Creating the Successful Business from Scratch. That's a book that she wrote with her late sister and business partner, TD. Miko, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Bronner Brothers International Beauty Show starts Saturday at the Georgia World Congress Center in Atlanta. When we talk about the Jim Crow South, we often talk about segregation between blacks and whites. But racial tension had a broad effect on everyone living in the South. Drinking fountains were often labeled either white or black, but many Latinos wondered which one they were supposed to use and whether or not segregated lunch counters meant they weren't welcome also. In her new book, University of Oregon history professor Julie Wise tracks the mass migration of Latinos to the South and what they faced when they got here. And she joins me now. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Celeste.
We also have Javier Gonzalez with us. He's a descendant of some of those early migrants. He grew up doing field work, but these days he oversees multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tifton. It's good to have you as well, Javier.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Celeste.
When did your family arrive in Georgia?
We started settling in Georgia in the late 1970s.
And you came from where, Texas?
From Texas, yes, South Texas.
So how did you end up here?
Well, my parents were recruited. Back then, farmers hired recruiters to go out, and they would go to South Texas and other places to recruit farm labor. And my parents were one of those that saw the advertisements and said, let's try this, and packed up our family and ended up in Georgia.
And the thing is, having looked at your bio, Javier, it looks like you moved around a lot. So what was it about Georgia that made them stay?
It was full-year employment. As migrant workers, we would follow the crops. Or they would follow the crops, and we would follow. But in Georgia, he found stable year unemployment with one farmer who had worked for him and the family throughout the year.
So, Julie, how typical is that story, the story of Javier's family?
What I found in my research is that it's actually quite typical, that we have a long history going back really to the 1920s of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans being based in South Texas, or in some cases Mexico, and moving seasonally through the country to harvest crops, oftentimes spending summer in the Midwest. But what happened as Georgia's agricultural production became more seasonal, less cotton-based, was that people who were spending the winter months in places like Texas or Florida could find employment in Georgia, and they wouldn't have to go all the way to, let's say, the Midwest. So because of the climate of Georgia being able to accommodate crops in various different seasons, it became an attractive destination in the 1970s and 1980s for families like Javier's, based both in Texas and also in Florida, who would come to Georgia maybe for part of the year, then most of the year, and then maybe realize they could stay all year.
So, Javier, tell me about what does your family talk about when they talk about what seemed strange in Georgia? Were there things here that stuck out in terms of kind of a culture clash?
Definitely. One of the most vivid one is being exposed to the African-American population, because coming from South Texas and living there the majority of the year, most of our influence and people were people like ourselves. They spoke our language. They looked like us. And even when we traveled as groups, we mainly stayed within our little communities. We traveled to Florida, and Florida was the same. But it was coming to Georgia where we got to get an extended view and exposure to the African American population. That was one of the most vivid changes.
You know, Javier, I grew up in Southern California, and that's another place where the street, you know, look, I was, my hometown was Mission Viejo, and my high school mascot was a Diablo. Everywhere you go, things are in both Spanish and English.
Right.
That could not have been true here. Was there a language barrier that hadn't been there in Texas?
Oh, definitely, definitely. For my family and myself, it was academically challenging because we were doing well in Texas and under the bilingual programs that they have in South Texas. So we were functioning in our native Spanish language, and English was slowly being introduced as the student progressed through their education. The most difficult time was coming to Georgia, and South Georgia at that did not have the resources, either bilingual or English for speakers of other languages, to support what we needed.
So, Julie, you kind of begin your story of Mexicans in the South in 1910 or 1920. Why? What was happening then?
Well, the Mexican Revolution that unfolded over the course of the 19-teens is generally considered to be the most important precipitating event for the migrant streams that have really continued until this day, really until our recent recession, when we've seen net Mexican immigration effectively at zero. But prior to that, for a century, the Mexican Revolution was really the event that kicked off the modern Mexican migration to the United States. And while we are very aware that those immigrants were going to places like Texas, California, Chicago, it turns out that they were actually going all over the country. They were going to Alaska, they were going to Pennsylvania, and they were going to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas in the 19-teens, really through the first part of the 20th century.
You have some great examples in your book of how that played out, especially as the civil rights movement began to brew up in the South, and that sort of strange place that Latinos and Mexicans held, not quite sure where they belonged. Can you give me an example?
Yes, absolutely. So if we look, for example, at Arkansas, during the 1950s, Mexican workers who were imported on temporary contracts, these workers were known as braceros, which comes from the Spanish word for arm. And during the 1950s, Mexican workers did about 25% of the cotton labor in Arkansas. They were a completely ubiquitous presence in the Arkansas Delta. What we saw there was a very interesting dynamic wherein Mexicans and African Americans, in oral history interviews and through other documentary evidence, it becomes clear that they were spending their free time together, that Mexicans felt most comfortable in African American bars and honky-tonks, as they would call them. But at the same time, the Mexican immigrants are appealing to the Mexican consulate for the right to be admitted to white businesses and restaurants from which they were excluded. And they ultimately win that fight because the Mexican government says to the white employers, if you don't put pressure on these businesses and these public spaces to admit Mexicans, we're not going to give this area any bracero contracts next year. And because the farmers wanted that labor so badly, they worked very, very hard to secure Mexicans' admission to white public spaces. However, what's not really clear is that any of the Mexicans who were fighting those very fights actually wanted to spend their time in those places. They wanted to be recognized as equal. They wanted to be recognized as first-class citizens. They took up this issue. But all the evidence says that their free time, they actually preferred to spend time with African Americans.
So, Javier, let me take that straight to you and how that played out in your own personal life and with your family. You said it was Georgia was the first time you'd really been along a lot of African Americans. What did that look like in terms of socializing with your family?
Well, it was natural because that was the population that was doing the farm work. So we spent extended amounts of time out in the fields and the packing sheds and in social locations with that population. So socializing with them really promoted collaborations and friendships, particularly with that population more so than the white population.
Do you feel, and did your family feel, like they were in part of the civil rights movement, like as though that included Latinos in the South especially?
I don't believe so. My parents, they had basic education, primary level education, third and fifth grade educations, and their purpose for coming to Georgia was to do the work. So they were not involved, and we didn't know because lacking the language skills and the history skills, we were not aware of that struggle. It wasn't until later that we were established that we started, or I myself started, to notice differences and wondering why these things are that. And then I realized the integration had just occurred, relatively speaking, and the school system in particular were struggling to figure out where we as the Mexican in-between population fit within those dynamics.
Where did you go to a segregated school?
No, I did not. But I did go to a school where there was tracking placement of students in tiers depending on their ability or potential. So when we enrolled in schools, we were placed in the lowest tiers possible. Some of my siblings were even placed in special education classes because I believe their lack of English proficiency. And we had to work our way through those barriers to get into the higher achieving groups.
We're going to return to that in just a moment, Javier, because you're getting close to finishing your PhD now, right?
It's an EdD program, yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing leap. But Julie, help me understand. You know, I found it interesting. I want to read you a sentence that's from your promotional material, which I don't often do, but I found this interesting. They said that in your book you talk about how Latinos in the South shaped the Southern conservative imagination in the wake of the civil rights movement. What does that mean?
Well, what I'm referring to there is specifically things that were happening in South Georgia during the time that Javier's family was coming. And I'd be very interested in Javier's perspective about this as well. But what I argue in the book and what I found in my research is that this is a period when white Southerners are really beginning to be looked at by the rest of the country as the bad guys of the civil rights movement, the people who stood in the way of what ultimately came to be accepted as a somewhat general consensus that legal segregation was wrong. And of course, many, if not most, of these people came themselves to accept the idea that the harshness of the Jim Crow system was something that had to be placed into the past. At the same time, they were reaching out, other scholars have established, they were reaching out to African-American leaders, pastors, asking for forgiveness, that kind of thing. But that was extremely complicated. That was a very complicated way of making amends because not all of these African-American leaders wanted to simply say, yeah, we're going to forget about everything that happened, you know, since slavery times. Well, all of a sudden at this moment, enter this new population of Mexicans. Many of these conservative white Southerners had been on missions in Latin America. They had learned some Spanish. And so what we saw during this period of, I'll say, the 1970s, really through the 90s, was a somewhat quiet and uneasy peace in southern Georgia and similar agricultural areas, where on the one hand, you didn't have the migrant workers, as Javier said, organizing and protesting the way that migrant workers were doing really in many other parts of the country.
Cesar Chavez and similar things
in Florida and in Ohio, but not in Georgia. Similarly, you didn't see any real anti-immigrant movement coming neither from white nor black people in South Georgia's agricultural areas. Instead, there was this uneasy peace, and I argue that this was largely, or in some ways, an opportunity for conservative white Southerners, particularly those affiliated with churches, to sort of redeem themselves, to have this population that did not look like them, that represented difference, that they could go out to the camps, bring people food, charter buses to bring them to church. Conservative white Southerners who would invite 30 Mexican migrants over for Christmas, for dinner.
So that's the broad experience. Javier, give us the individual experience. Did you find among at least your family and the people that you knew, there was neither a big, strong political push for civil rights nor a feeling of anti-immigrant backlash?
Exactly. Just thinking on Julie's words, that the farmer who my parents settled with kind of took us in and made us part of his family. We shared Thanksgiving. He brought Christmas gifts, him and his wife and his extended family. So we were taken care of in that way. There was never a distinction where you would say, you know, we're being treated wrong or something's not right here. And just thinking back on that, it was more of a mutual respect relationship than a worker-employer relationship.
So before we go, Javier, I want to return to the story of your education, because as I understand it, you actually keep a letter framed on your desk from one of your early teachers.
Yes. And this is from Virginia Roberts, and it's dated November 19th, 1980.
What grade were you in at this point?
fifth grade, I believe.
Okay.
And it was when I moved to our permanent school system from another school system within Georgia. And it says, to whom it may concern, please do not judge Javier's ability by the grades he received from me. He is a very capable, polite person. His work was very good until he began being absent 1 to 3 days a week. His absence seemed to be due to the temporary nature of his father's job. Javier's concern for his schoolwork seemed lessened when the cucumber crop came in. My plea to you is give him a few days to adjust to the new school. You will find him easy to learn and a pleasure to teach.
Why do you keep this? I mean, it's like an absolute reflection of your family and the realization of the American dream in one way. But why do you keep that on your desk?
It motivates me. It makes me realize that people do care. I didn't see my potential at that age, obviously. But someone else took interest in me and made sure that whoever was going to be receiving me at the next school felt the same way.
That is Javier Gonzalez. He's the director of multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tifton, Georgia. I also spoke with University of Oregon professor Julie Wise. She's the author of the book Corazón de Dixie, which means Heart of Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910. Julie and Javier, thank you both so much.
Thank you both.
That's our show for today, but tomorrow is Friday, and I want you to join the break room with me. We'll talk about student loans. U.S. Marshals have started arresting people who've defaulted on their loans. Do you have a student loan? What do you think is the solution to the $1.2 trillion owed in student loans in this country? Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk, or you can just post on Facebook. Our show is produced by Sean Powers and Linda Chen with help from Taylor Gant. Lindsay Foster Thomas is our senior producer. Our engineer is Ryan Thomas. Tanya Ott is our vice president of radio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.